I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC original podcast.
Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a brand new show from the makers of the award-winning podcast, Criminal. They've made a new show that has nothing to do with crime. This show is about love. Stories of sacrifice, obsession, and the ways in which we bet everything on each other. Stories like a woman who becomes a best-selling novelist by writing more than 100 books about her first romance. Or a teenage girl who saves a baby whale by staying with it in the ocean for hours. The show is called This Is Love. Find them at thisislovepodcast.com or subscribe in iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Unrequited love is often the best love of all because it lasts the longest.
From CBC, this is Love Me, a show about the messiness of human connection. I'm Lou. Episode 6, Lost and Found. Many years ago, I was going through a rough patch with a boyfriend of mine. We'd been together for 5 years, and I wanted to get married. He wasn't so sure. He wasn't even sure if he wanted to stay together. And so I said, listen, if you can live without me, you should. But he couldn't really decide. So we went to couples therapy to figure it out. And after about 6 months, I realized that I could live without him. And so I told him, I think I can live without you. But I can't live without your mother. And I won't. And I haven't. His mom became my role model for being old. I wouldn't have it any other way.
My mom died of breast cancer when I was 5. I knew she was dying, and she encouraged me to be open with my emotions, to not be afraid to cry. I spent much of her last year sitting with her in bed, playing with her jewelry and reading books. I was there when her friend came over to help her pick out a prosthetic breast, and when her dad came over to help her pick out a tombstone. Before she died, she told her cousin that she thought I was gay and maybe transgender. In an alternate universe, we would have made the perfect match of an overbearing but fabulous Jewish mother and a neurotic gay son. Instead, my dad remarried 2 years after my mom's death to a woman I was afraid of. She would get in big fights with everyone in the family and sometimes throw things. She once told me I didn't have any friends and that nobody liked me. With my mom gone and no real maternal figure at home, I turned elsewhere. When I was 7, I would visit my great aunt Mary in New Hampshire. She taught me how to sew quilts, and we went bird watching and blueberry picking together. During many visits, I would end up crying in her arms, telling her how unhappy I was at home. "You are going to make it," she would tell me, as we counted down the years until I could move out. I once asked her if I could call her mom. She said she wasn't comfortable with that kind of responsibility. And I never asked anybody that question again. When I was 10, I met a woman at a local coffee shop. Her name was Karen. Karen ran the after-school program there. She had 2 kids and called me her 3rd. I knew she was joking, but it felt good. She would give me rides, buy me snacks, and take me back to school shopping. Sometimes she would bring me over to her house to play the piano and sing for her. But once her kids graduated from high school, she moved out of town. At 14, while traveling with my family in Spain, I became friendly with the owner of our bed and breakfast, and she invited me to visit her the following summer. Her name was Lorena. I ended up living with her for 3 summers during high school. She didn't speak English, so I became good at Spanish. One time at a wedding, we convinced her acquaintances that I was Polish and that she had adopted me, which made us both laugh. But she was a member of Opus Dei, and we had a falling out when her housekeeper saw me hanging around a gay club. At 17, I met my friend's mom and ended up living with her for a summer during college. Then I moved in with her after I graduated. Her name was Nancy. She was divorced and living alone since her kids moved out. We did everything together. We cooked, went out drinking, threw parties, walked the dog. When I left to take a job across the country, we both had a terrible time saying goodbye. The night of my goodbye party, we ended up by the fountain in the park, crying in each other's laps. I had a nervous breakdown less than a week after I moved away and wound up in the ER. For the first time since my mom died, I began to see a therapist and talk about the role these women played in my life. She suggested that they were maternal replacements and that having to say goodbye to Nancy was like losing my mother all over again. It made sense, but it irked me a little. These women were some of my best friends, and chalking our relationship up to my motherlessness made me feel like a pity case, like our relationships were part of a tragedy. About a year later, at 23, I met another woman at a concert. We became friends after she flashed her underwear at a cop and invited him to the local gay bar. Her name was Stephanie. She was 40 with two young kids. I'd go to her place after work, and we'd fix dinner, make dirty martinis, and watch trashy television. Then I'd read to her kids before bed. Within a year of moving to a new place, I'd already befriended another woman old enough to be my mom. By now, I'm used to the strange looks when I tell people some of my closest friends are women twice my age or more. But I'm still irked by the idea that I'm using them as maternal replacements. Yeah, these women supported me during some of my most vulnerable times. But I like to think they got something out of our relationships too. Aunt Mary tells me she always looked forward to my visits. She was lonely up on that lake in New Hampshire. Karen says taking care of me, giving me rides, taking me back to school shopping, helped her feel more worthwhile. She was in a bad marriage, and it felt good to have people depend on her. Lorena and I don't speak anymore, but I know I made her laugh a lot during those summer visits. For Stephanie, much of her life is defined by being a mom. Together we get away from that, go out for cocktails, talk politics, share doubts. And then there's Nancy. After the first summer I spent living with her, she wrote me a letter and gave me a bracelet with a small gold key on it. She wrote, "This is a small token to thank you for the best summer I've had in the last 10 years. I love the courtyard conversations till the wee hours of the night, the steady stream of new friends you brought through the house. But mostly, I loved learning about you." The small key on this bracelet is symbolic, letting you know you're always welcome in any house I call home. It was the nicest thing anybody had ever given to me. A couple months ago, we marked the 20th anniversary of my mom's death. At 25, I've spent almost all of my life without her. I'm used to not having somebody to call mom, and it's something I've made peace with. So, I didn't grow up with my own overbearing but fabulous Jewish mother, but I did grow up with Mary, Karen, Lorena, Nancy, and Stephanie. They stepped in throughout my life and allowed me into theirs. Not because I was their son, but because they wanted to. And I feel lucky for that.
In 1974, I was working in the provincial park in Manitoba as a garbage collector. I really enjoyed working on the garbage truck because We were outside all the time. We had a lot of free time, so there was a lot of napping. And then when we went to the dump, there was another, I don't know, 20, 30 minutes where we had time to have another nap. I first met Paul when he came to work on the garbage truck. He was my main partner. Very, very quiet person and very soft-spoken. He was probably one of the most thoughtful guys that I knew. He would go out of his way to help people. He was a good lister, that's for sure. I think I talked more than he did. For the 3 years that we worked together, it was at times almost like we could read each other's minds because we got so good at anticipating what was going to happen next. In the park, the beach was about 10 feet below the roadway, and instead of running up and down the stairs all the time, one of us would go down to the beach, usually me because I was a little bit stronger, and we would throw the garbages up to the person above us. So that person had to be paying attention because otherwise they would fall back on the person down on the beach's head. You know, it was like playing a game of catch, right? And he always caught it. The last day, end of summer, as was the tradition, there was a wind-up party for the park staff. Everybody was going back to university or going off to school, and Paul had planned to take an extended trip backpacking through Europe. So we were going our separate ways and wouldn't see each other for a while. The night of the party, I got home very, very late, probably around 4 a.m. At around 6 a.m., Paul showed up at my parents' house and asked if he could speak to me. We went for a walk on a road near my parents' house, and Paul said, "There's something I've been meaning to tell you. I should have told you earlier, but I am in love with you." I was shocked because he had never showed any interest in me in that way. I said, "I'm not sure how to react to this, Paul, because I thought we were friends. I can't say that I have the same feelings for you." And as was his character, he didn't react very strongly. He said, "Okay, I understand," and then he got in his old car and drove off. I never saw him again. The rumor was that he had joined the priesthood. In all the summers that I knew him, he had not spoken about religion. And a little part of me felt that I had somehow been his last chance or something like that. And people would laugh about it and tease me about that, that I drove him into the priesthood. A few years later, I started a relationship with a young man, and we got married. You know, you get to a certain age and you're supposed to get married, right? Like, that was the expectation. And here's another thing. I'm ashamed to admit it, but he was in law school, so it was like, "Oh, you must marry a lawyer." You know? And in 1999... my husband died by suicide. I was coping with that for years and years and years. I wonder all the time if I made a whole bunch of bad choices. You know, maybe if I'd have shown a little more interest in Paul, maybe something could have developed there. But I had a tough childhood. And given my history, I had a hard time knowing that I could be loved. Accepting that I could be loved in such a way as Paul was presenting to me. That it was real. I knew it was real. It was just, well, I didn't feel that way about him. I had a hard time understanding why he would be attracted to me so deeply. I have thought about tracking him down, and a few of my friends have joked about now that because I'm a widow, that I should try to talk to him. But, I mean, he has dedicated his life to the priesthood, so I guess my curiosity is, was I really his one last chance? Like, am I the force that turned him away from a more mainstream kind of life? I also wonder if he had an interest in a relationship with a woman, if that part of him is, you know, still there or dormant or something and has just been kind of pushed down. A friend of mine grew up in a small town where he was the parish priest, and she talked to him about me, and he got embarrassed and he started stuttering and blushing after all these years. I got his number from the parish website. I don't have any idea how he's going to react. He may not even want to talk to me.
Thank you for calling St. Parish. Sunday Mass times are as follows: Saturday at 4 p.m. and Sunday at 9:30 and 11:30 a.m. If you would like to leave a message, please wait for the sound of the beep. Blessings to you.
Hi, I'm trying to get a hold of Paul. I used to work with him a long time ago, and I am interested in making contact with him. So I'll leave my number. My number is and my name is Donna, and I worked with Paul in 1974 on the garbage truck. Thank you. It's been 2 months now since I left that message for Paul, and I haven't heard back from him. But that's the way life is, right? People come and go, and sometimes they come back in, and sometimes they're gone.
Love Me is produced by Mira Burt-Wintonik and Crystal Duhame. On today's show, you heard Galen Druk. To see photos from his story and to find a link to more of Galen's work, visit cbc.ca/loveme. You also heard Donna Basil. Donna is the author of a book of short stories, Lessons from a Nude Man. Original theme music by Tim Kingsbury. Scoring music by Murray Lightburn. Additional music by Chris Zabriskie and Malt Tabulated Sounds. Special thanks to Veronica Simmons for editing help on this episode. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or at cbc.ca/loveme. I'm Lou Olkowski. Here's a taste of next week's show.
I didn't realize how special you were. You did nothing wrong. You're perfect.
Always get a voiceover actor to play your ex.
Okay.
Always. Because it's the only way you get them to say what you want.
You're perfect.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.